said you can kill my body, but you know you can't mess with my mind.
Welcome to Economics and Beyond. I'm Rob Johnson, president of the Institute for New Economic Thinking.
Say you can kill my body.
Say you can kill my body.
But you know you can't mess with my mind.
Say no, you can't kill my mind.
You know we'll go away.
We're gonna go away.
Come back, come back, come back,
come back.
My second time.
This is Rob Johnson, president of the Institute for New Economic Thinking. I'm here today with Pavlina Cherneva, associate professor of economics at Bard College and a research associate at the Levian Institute. She's just written an outstanding book on the case for a job guarantee. It's published by Polity Press in 2020 and obviously been a very inspiring source of conversation. And Pavlina, I want to thank you for joining me today and continuing the conversation.
Thank you, Rob. Thank you for having me.
We are in a time where a lot of what I will call conventional wisdom, which kept things from being put on the table for consideration, is in question. There is a kind of unmasking of a lot of false constructs. Given the pandemic, given some of the distribution of the results of the we might call the countercyclical efforts that have been made to counteract it, and there are a lot of people very anxious about what this portends for climate change. There are people fighting about the question of whether we've used up our fiscal capacity. And many of these issues I know you have a great deal to say about, but let's just start with, what are you seeing that disturbs you? What do you wish you were seeing that's omitted? And what are you seeing that you want to point a finger to and inspire people to follow?
Yes, thank you, Rob. I mean, there are currently, I think, some seismic shifts and some changes that are happening at a glacial pace, not fast enough. There is a hunger, a palpable hunger for new ideas on how to rebalance the economy, how to make sure that it works for all, that it provides sustainable future. And there, I think there's a perfect storm of problems that are coming into sharp focus, from climate change to the mass unemployment and impoverishment from the COVID pandemic to the quiet insecurity, economic insecurity that has been building up for decades. And, you know, the great financial crisis, I think, shook the profession in ways that it hadn't previously, to start thinking about new ideas, start developing new policies emerging from these new ideas. But I think the change did not happen quickly enough. I think this is another moment that we are facing. And we are starting to realize that government and government policy are critical and essential to rebalance the economy. So I think what I'm finding encouraging in this moment is this conversation that we see from various corners of civil society, of the economics profession, of politics, that are asking that question: what is the future that we want? And what is the collective effort that is required to bring that future as embodied by public policy? So I see it a bit as a pendulum swing from the Reagan revolution, which basically denied the role for collective action and for public policy in pretty fundamental ways. So the conversation is shifting. What I am, you know, obviously, hoping will happen a little faster than we've seen after 2008, is coalesce around ideas that are sharper, that are bolder, that are more precise in terms of addressing various aspects of economic insecurity. I write on the problem of unemployment, but we can extend this conversation to climate policy, which is not happening at a fast enough rate. We can extend it to healthcare policy, which is also not being reformed at a fast enough pace. And so these are important moments. And as the saying goes, never let a good crisis go to waste. And I think that we have to seize yet again this moment to truly implement some better policies going forward, because this is not going to be the last crisis we're going to be facing.
I would have put you and Rahm Emanuel on the same page. That's interesting.
Even a broken clock.
Right, twice a day. That's right.
At
any rate, so you've written this book, The Case for Job Guarantee. Tell me about what inspired you. What did you see, and what triggered your focusing your energy and bringing forward these ideas?
Yeah, the book is a primer on the job guarantee, but my work on the job guarantee has been developing for a couple of decades, maybe a bit more. In fact, my very earliest work in economics was on thinking through macroeconomic stabilization in new ways. I have been inspired by the works of Keynes and Minsky. Early in my research, I was taken aback by economists' treatment of full employment. It is one of those things that is assumed to be always there in the economy, and yet everybody knows that even in normal circumstances, the economy doesn't operate at full capacity. And so, you know, my very first impression of the discipline that I was studying was that there was a quiet surrender to the idea that unemployment is ever present. There was a lip service to full employment, almost a magic wand of the market equilibrating processes that will bring about that, you know, socially optimal outcomes. And at the same time, I was reading Keynes and Minsky, who were arguing that, well, the economic system is not a natural system. It's a social system. That the conventional way of thinking about the economy essentially says that it denies what is happening right before us. We have regular periodic periods of mass unemployment. And even in the best of times, there are millions out of work. And so these were the sort of questions that initially, piqued my intellectual interest. And then I went down this path of exploring Keynes's own work, which in my view has been grossly misinterpreted by the profession, and trying to uncover, some of the precise theoretical reasons for the Keynesian policy proposals for public works, for public employment, etc. And, essentially what comes out from my macroeconomic work is that the way fiscal policy tends to stabilize an unstable economy fails to address these two outstanding faults of economic society that Keynes was talking about and Minsky echoed, and that is the failure to produce full employment and also the arbitrary and inequitable distribution of income. So we see that over time, our societies have become more unequal, our labor markets have become more precarious, and that is in a what you would might call a Keynesian era. So where did we go wrong? And so my initial interest was on rethinking fiscal policy, macroeconomic stabilization. I had early, again, in my college career, worked on a little math model on what is now known as modern monetary theory. But the basic math model was basically offering an alternative to the Phillips curve, that there need not be a trade-off between inflation and unemployment. And in fact, there might be a way of producing stable an environment of full employment with stable prices. So that's where the questions were a bit esoteric, but macro, you know, they were directly related to policy and macroeconomic stabilization policy. And eventually that research led me to various other aspects of unemployment and the social costs of unemployment, and also the experiences that we can see around the world to address the problem. So the job guarantee in and of itself as a proposal is not new. You know, we tend to resurrect that conversation periodically. You could start from FDR's Economic Bill of Rights, where he articulated the right to employment as the first of these economic rights. You can find the right to decent remunerative employment in the UN Declaration of Human Rights. We know that this was a demand of the civil rights movement. And so periodically, the world reengages in this conversation, and we are yet again at that point. And we can see ways in which different countries and we here in the United States have tried to address the scourge of unemployment. So the job guarantee, I think, is certainly stands the shoulders of giants. It is a reinterpretation of past models with new, I hope, contributions to the discussion. And it's really a rejection of the status quo, both in theory and in policy.
Let's talk about the specific vision of the job guarantee and how it differs in its effect on the economy and on people and on income and wealth distribution, what we might call social sustainability.
Yes, I think the vision is really important. That is an important point of departure. And the basic question that this book asks is unemployment really natural? And if it is recurring, is it unavoidable? And what would be the world? What would the world look like if we had a policy of guaranteeing employment to all? And how would that compare to the present day? So the present day vision, and I think it comes a lot from the economics profession, but is, again, there's this quiet resignation that there is some level of unemployment that is natural. And to me, that is a, you know, economic concept that is jarring, that needs to be reexamined critically, but it is also pernicious. So, you know, students of economics know that, Milton Friedman and others before him had talked about the natural rate of unemployment. That concept eventually led to the other concept, the NIRU, the non-accelerating inflation rate of unemployment, which is some positive rate of unemployment that presumably will not trigger rising prices. Now, what's pernicious about this is that, well, empirically, this is a very difficult concept to demonstrate the existence of that natural rate of unemployment. But the second thing is that until recently, at least, it was regularly used as a policy guide. Right. So if policymakers, and typically that will be central banks, are charged with macromanaging the economy, how do they fine tune it using interest rates? So whether you look at the Taylor rule, whether you look at other macro models, there is that idea that below certain unemployment level, all sorts of terrible things might happen. Inflation might rear its ugly head. And thus the Federal Reserve in this case will need to step on the brakes to prevent this so-called, you know, undesirable outcome. Now, so we use unemployment, we genuinely in the profession use unemployment and destitution that comes with it as a policy guide when to stop stimulating the economy. So it's a whole other conversation to what degree the Fed has been capable of delivering maximum employment and price stability. But I'm encouraged by the fact that they are at least letting go a little bit of that idea, that notion that we should use the NIRU. You know, you have seen in recent statements of Jay Powell you know, even before the pandemic, a recognition that even with very low unemployment rate, there was plenty of labor market slack. There was a recognition that there is no inflation on the horizon. There was a mea culpa, if you will, where, you know, Fed officials were quite clear. We do not understand the processes that generate inflation. We don't know where the natural rate is. And so once you knock down these pieces that are, you know, pillars of economic thinking and economic policy, you have to then come up with another alternative. So the vision here is that there is a way of designing macro policy that does not rely on persistent positive unemployment and doesn't see it as natural and unavoidable. The job guarantee is that policy. I mean, in its very simplest terms, it's just a public option for jobs, but it does have these many different macroeconomic features that are superior to what the current paradigm of mass unemployment has.
And others I know who are concerned about that, which you might call the resilience of people, have talked about the universal basic income. How would you compare and contrast the impact and strengths of each alternative?
Yeah, I mean, universal basic income is a very different proposal from the job guarantee. And there are, I shall say, many different kinds of UBI proposals. So it is a little difficult to, you know, pick one. The one that I usually compare to the job guarantee is the proposal of providing to anyone, rich or poor, irrespective of labor market status, living income. You know, let's say $35,000 a year. So how would that policy compare to a job guarantee policy that provides employment opportunities on demand at $35,000 a year per person? And I think that before I even answer that question, it would be useful to compare the job guarantee to the current model of unemployment. So what the current environment is, it uses unemployment as a stabilizer. Even if we toss it just a standard graph of the unemployment rate, we see that it is extremely volatile phenomena, right? It shoots up in downturns and very slowly recovers. So I call it a yo-yo effect, and that's a human yo-yo effect. That, you know, we regularly tolerate an economy that will, you know, dispose of workers, if you will, relegate them to mass unemployment. And then we're going to slog through jobless recoveries to bring back jobs. And we're going to do counter-cyclical traditional stabilization that has not been terribly effective and has tolerated jobless recovery. So when you compare those scenarios, the job guarantee is a different kind of automatic stabilizer that displaces unemployment. It provides jobs when they're needed. Right? And when you provide a job when it's needed, you actually prevent these avalanche effects of layoffs. You know, somebody has a job, they can still maintain their livelihood. They don't, you know, stop suddenly their expenditures and cost somebody else their job. So the job guarantee has a counter-cyclical feature, much like unemployment does, but it's a better counter-cyclical feature. The UBI proposal, as it stands, is a very large fiscal intervention that does not have the same kind of counter-cyclical feature because it is supposed to be provided rain or shine, irrespective of economic conditions, labor market status, etc. And so, you know, it could be a very large fiscal impulse. It could be anywhere between 14 and 25% of GDP, and it's a persistent. So fiscal policy typically has anti-cyclical features. So in a way, from a macroeconomic perspective, it doesn't have these benefits. I appreciate sort of the moral and ethical concerns of providing security in an environment where folks are struggling in many ways. But the job guarantee resolves one very critical aspect of economic insecurity, and that is the absence of a job. So the next thing that I would say about the UBI is what we know from experiments, you know, small, they're basic income experiments. They're nothing close to this generous UBI that I'm discussing. What we know is that while people's lives are improved, they still need work. They're still looking for jobs, and jobs are still scarce. So in a way, the job guarantee actually resolves that problem. It directly addresses the problem of perennial unemployment. And it's that security that whatever your reasons, if you need at a minimum a living wage job opportunity, it will be there. Where with UBI, we might be able to provide some support, but not the jobs that are necessary. We're still faced with an unemployment buffer stock, right? Unemployment is still going to yo-yo. And also, you know, we want to make sure that, you know, that income is generally genuinely empowering. We know that economic insecurity is far more than just the absence of income.
Now, I have often heard people talk about, if you will, we can't afford it. When you have done estimates, I know at the Libby Institute and others, of what's the scale in terms of, say, a percentage of GDP through thick and thin of being able to implement a policy of this sort?
Yeah, you know, that argument of we can't afford it is always very, very interesting, because it's applied to, you know, the climate crisis, we can't afford green investment. It's applied to healthcare, we can't afford, it's too expensive. That's what most people don't realize, is that of course we can afford it. We're already paying for it. Unemployment is already paid for. Part of what I do in the book is discuss the many costs, social and economic costs, that come with mass unemployment. So if we just need to shift the perspective, what are we paying for? We will be paying for poverty, unemployment, for meals on wheels, for school lunches, for homelessness, all of the other interventions for social problems that are in one way or another connected to the unemployment problem. We will be paying to address the mass opioid epidemic, the increased healthcare costs, very well documented, that come from mass unemployment. And the costs are borne by not just the unemployed themselves, they are borne by their family, their children, by municipalities in terms of lost output, lost tax revenue, and on and on and on it goes. And if we were to truly reflect on those costs that are already existing and incurring, then yes, of course we can afford it. And of course, it is going to be less expensive in real human costs. We're going to be saving lives. High correlation between unemployment, suicide rate, increased mortality. So in that sense, I like to talk about affordability in terms of these broader costs that are already there, that the government is responsible for, the public sector is responsible for. In terms of the financial costs, is what people often worried about. Again, we are committing financial resources nevertheless. But it's... to answer your specific question, you know, our estimates show that the job guarantee would be anywhere between 1.3 and 1.5 and 3% of GDP. It's a very small program as a part of the budget of GDP, but we modeled a pretty ambitious policy. We modeled a policy that employed 15 million people and offered wages and benefits of $35,000 per person. That number is to me not very relevant. It is very possible that we have not accounted for all the cost savings. I mean, I know we haven't accounted for all the cost savings, because, you know, we did not account for the reduction in healthcare costs, the healthcare costs. We didn't account for the reductions in incarceration costs and many other things. So if you were to offset account for all of these reductions, it could be budget neutral. Is this going to be a criteria for me, whether it's worthwhile or not? No, because that's an arbitrary kind of accounting number. And what we know is, when it comes to public policy, to automatic stabilizers, they need to be there through thick and thin. They will be a crisis when the job guarantee needs to expand, and then perhaps it will become a larger share of GDP. But what we see in the midst of crises is that the government never has trouble paying the bills. It never has trouble appropriating the necessary budgets to deal with crises. If you remember 2008, right, we passed the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act. That was, you know, $850 billion. And it was very large by historical standards. We had appropriated even bigger budgets for TARP and for addressing the financial crisis. And so that happened literally overnight. We didn't call up any wealthy donors or taxpayers. We didn't borrow any money from China. We used the fiscal, the government financing institutions to appropriate these budgets and pay the bills. At that time, of course, the $800+ billion Recovery Act was enough, I had estimated, to create 20 million living wage jobs. But we didn't target it the right way. So we had the financing capacity, no doubt, but we did not target it in a way to create a job-led recovery. Instead, we aimed to stabilize investment, finance, in hope that that will recover confidence and bring jobs back. But we saw that was the longest jobless recovery we had seen at that time. What did we do in March? We were faced with yet another crisis. That was the pandemic crisis. We appropriated $2.2 trillion budget overnight, dwarfing previous efforts, and that's about 10% of GDP. Again, that was enough to cover the entire payroll in the United States and to employ every single unemployed person into a job guarantee program at a living wage. So clearly, finding the money is not the concern here, but how it is directed. And you know, my preference would have been if policy did everything that they could do to protect jobs, to prevent layoffs, to guarantee that employment security, so that we don't have to be faced with the looming unemployment problem that we are faced with today. Doing a job guarantee with 5 million people is obviously much more desirable than doing a job guarantee with 20 million people.
You know, you're bringing us, what you might call, into connection with modern monetary theory, with the notions that people have of, quote, scarcity, we can't afford it, the kind of arguments that have thwarted progressive actions on the part of the state in years past. And I think that people are quite sensitive now to the prospect of climate change. When people say, well, we can't afford the monetary expansion because it will lead to inflation, I hear people who are not economists, but kind of funny, say to me, well, yeah, we could have 2% inflation and all die, or we could have 4% inflation and transform the energy structure of society. I think I'd vote for 4% inflation and things of that nature, that this the sacredness of price stability has to be examined. But even more than that, you know, with the notion of a Green New Deal, with the notion of all of these things being frustrated by the notion that we can't afford it, you say, how can we afford the TARP bill? How can we afford, as you called it, the $3 trillion bailout, which largely supported and amplified large-scale corporations, investment firms, and banks? And, you know, people make the argument that those channels, which you might call parts of the plumbing, are necessary conditions, that if they collapse, everything goes down the drain with them. But that also then argues for all kinds of policies about prior restraint to restrict the moral hazard of those who know they are, quote, too big to fail. And I just, this is when we talked at the outset about the unmasking. I don't know how anybody makes sense of these scarcity arguments. They don't scare you away from defending the powerful, but they are used to thwart the underpinnings of the weaker elements of society, and that is contributing to the deterioration of faith in government. And what concerns me most is it's contributing to what you might call the despair and the attraction to authoritarian, the vulnerability to authoritarian demagoguery.
Yeah, I completely have to agree. I mean, to carry the theme of pernicious arguments, this is another. We can't afford it. It's a really, really pernicious argument. We have designed institutions and systems that provide us with the kind of financing capacity that is required to address our basic human needs and existential crises. So, you know, when you bring up the contributions of modern monetary theory, you know, MMT has for a long time tried to look at the plumbing of the financial system just to see how on regular day the Treasury, the Federal Reserve, government spending are going to interact. And just to lift the veil on this argument that somehow there are hard and binding constraints. But when you see a crisis, that really concentrates the mind. That is a very important teachable moment, because literally overnight, we see how government mobilizes those institutions it has created to fund whatever policy priority is on the table. And it is self-funded. It has its own financial resources. And so the arguments that we can't afford it are just, you know, really, very weak on the face of them, because we just see crisis after crisis after crisis, government steps in and spends as needed. But they are pernicious from a social, ecological, human perspective, because they are used as ideological tools to be told that what we need for a good society, we just cannot afford. At the same time, as you point out, we periodically see the readiness and willingness to, you know, make whole financial actors who have contributed or been the cause of financial instability. And so people understand this. They understand that there is money for wars, endless wars. There is not money for eradicating poverty. And I think, this is another conversation that I'm encouraged to see is changing, not fast enough. But it is time for folks to say no to the scarcity mentality, because it comes from the wrong place. It's saying we don't have the financial resources. Financial resources are not scarce. They are created, they are not limited. Government has its funding powers. What's scarce is real resources. The environment is burning, right? We can run out of clean air. We can run out of clean water. And so when I talk about these issues, I always distinguish between financial resources and real resources. Try to shift the focus on the real aspects of our life that matter. And those may be limited by the availability of resources. Do we have enough technology to very quickly transform the energy grid into more sustainable energy production? Do we have the resources to create jobs in every community as needed to provide meaningful employment opportunities? My answer to that question is, I think yes. But we are not even there, because the question that is often raised is that, oh, well, what will happen to the government budget if it explodes? We need to address the budget. You know, nobody needs to address the deficit problem of the budget. We need to address the deficit problem in education, the deficit problem in housing, the deficit in clean water. And so we are completely talking about the wrong things. And I think, you know, if it does require increased government expenditure to deliver a sustainable future, we can certainly employ the financial resources to do it. If that brings us closer to some sort of productivity barrier and generates some inflation, we also have tools to deal with that. We don't have to sacrifice jobs or livelihood to fight inflation. There are multiple ways. And I think this is where I would like to see the discipline go. To think more critically about the way to tackle the real resource constraints, not the financial, artificially made constraints.
That's a very concise way of raising the challenge. One of the things that often bothers me, and I think it's probably because I worked in the United States Senate for 6 years, is that people act like there is some sort of separation between economics and politics, or economics and governance. But these policies, which have all kinds of distributional effects, are part of a struggle. And sometimes the words that are used to criticize or defend them are what you might call marketing for the various interests in that struggle. People like Manker Olson, Logic of Collective Action, talked about the structure of diffuse interests versus powerful concentrated interests and things of that nature. But when you look at the United States right now, and you look at a job guarantee, it would obviously it might not on net add very much to the cost to the government, but people who like tax cuts or keeping their money offshore would like to continue to say we can't afford it, so that it didn't impose what you might call an impetus for raising taxes on them. Companies who are always interested in the profit share relative to the wage share, even though they've done wonderfully over the last few decades from their vantage point, could see this job guarantee taking us back in the other direction. So I guess I'm looking at our politics, and I would allege that the role of money in our politics in what I would call refracting the quality and breadth of representation, particularly when concentrated income and wealth are accompanied by corporations being called people. And so I guess what I'm trying to do is move us towards what's the struggle that you perceive? How do we overcome the resistance to implementing the kind of policies like the job guarantee, when it quite simply does have these distributional consequences, which you or I might think are good, but it also means it's going to meet resistance when people are doing fundraisers for political elections and what have you. Do we got to reform the politics in order to get good policy? Or do you think the pandemic has shocked us enough that we might be able to go right to the good policy?
Well, it's a very complicated question, isn't it? I begin from first. Let's put on the table different questions. I think, we need to start asking questions that were not permitted before. So in terms of the political economy of full employment, the critical thing here is the threat of unemployment is a powerful thing. And, it's been well recognized that firms, captains of industry, would like to keep the threat of unemployment as a tool over their workers' wages, benefits, conditions of employment. However, what we do in economics is we pretend that's not really the problem. We talk about a natural rate. So the natural rate of unemployment is the veil. And so what I'm hoping the job guarantee would do is, the book will do is lift that veil and say, well, there's nothing natural about it. And not only, but there are unemployment is paid for, unemployment is expensive. The current policies that are passed in the name of job creation don't actually create full employment. And so let's put that aside and present an alternative of securing it. Now, once we demonstrate the effectiveness of job guarantee from social economic point of view and macroeconomic stabilization point of view, then we can have a much more balanced dialogue. So what is the opposition? Things become clearer then. If we can do it, then it is an ideological opposition. It's not a practical or technocratic. There are no technocratic reasons why we can't do job guarantee. It is an ideological opposition. And so, we've seen this, we see it time and again. You know, during FDR's New Deal, it was amazing how business interests still preferred the dole than jobs because they still wanted to wield that power and exercise that power over workers to pay low wages. And the fact that workers who worked for the New Deal projects began to perceive these projects as their right. They began to perceive the government as responsible for guaranteeing that employment. That was enormously threatening to business interests. And so I think that, you know, no doubt these are big obstacles before us, but we can't presume we can tackle them if we have the conversation based on the wrong premises and, you know, and surrendering to the wrong, you know, the wrong frames. That, you know, somehow unemployment is natural and unavoidable, and then the question is, you know, how do you make change? I mean, there's another layer to this. Unemployment structures all sorts of economic and social injustices. You know, when somebody argues for the inevitability of unemployment, they're essentially arguing that in the labor market someone is going to lose out, and then the next question has to be who's going to lose out. Is it going to be people of color? Is it going to be people with disabilities? Is it going to be caregivers? And the answer is yes, yes, and yes. So again, we don't want to defend a system that is so unjust. The job guarantee will not be a panacea to the labor market problems, but it is one step forward of leveling the playing field and saying, hey, we actually have a guaranteed living wage floor for all. Now we got to do better to address discrimination, sexism, and all of that. But we've already removed one powerful, powerful tool of social and economic injustice, which is mass unemployment. At the policy level, you know, I think, as FDR would say, you know, make me do it. I'm encouraged by the many different corners of the economy that are recognizing the job guarantee as a critical piece to various other social policy agendas, like the Green New Deal. It's called one of the most crucial components of the Green New Deal. And I think that there is a recognition in the climate movement that up to now, jobs were always fossil fuel jobs, always held the conversation hostage because communities didn't want to lose the few jobs they relied on for a green future that didn't guarantee employment for all. But now with the job guarantee, we promise that transition is guaranteed to everyone. And the Paris Climate Accord also recognizes that just climate transition means also just transition for the workforce, consistent with human rights objectives. So I think that all of these things are new developments that are important. Housing guarantee movement is recognizing the importance of the job guarantee policy. Everything is connected to everything. And the more we understand the economy as, again, not a natural organism, but as a socially structured organism, then we understand that we have a powerful say on what it's going to look like. And we just, can move forward productively into that active conversation.
Another realm, coming back to central banking, you mentioned Fed Governor Powell, is that these notions like the natural rate of unemployment or the Phillips curve trade-off or whatever, they seem to have decomposed, or perhaps they never were, but there isn't a great deal, particularly with the transformation through technology, the production side of the economy, globalization, and so forth, that with all of the disruption, it doesn't seem at all possible that for them to act like what you might call they're running a mechanical system with predictable consequences and trade-offs and so forth in light of what we've experienced over the last 10 or 12 years.
Yeah. You know, I think this is a very interesting question, Rob. I think it's also a very deep theoretical question. You know, when we think about how economists conceive of macroeconomic stabilization, I mean, what we've inherited from the neoclassical synthesis is this extremely hydraulic view of the world, right? That whether it is, you know, we might be debating, you know, whether fiscal policy or monetary policy is more potent, But at bottom, there is this assumption that whichever arm does it, it could do it in this hydraulic way. You push a button here, something else happens elsewhere, right? And we raise interest rates, you know, something happens to investment. We lower them. There will be fine tuning that might take place through monetary policy. But it's the same thing for fiscal policy as well. You know, there's some notion of boosting aggregate demand, trying to pass budgets of certain size. And again, to me, that is a misguided way of looking at it. What we need to be looking at is very precisely, very concretely, at what kind of demand, not aggregate, targeted. We certainly need to have scale. You know, a bigger downturn is going to require bigger scale action. You know, Keynes, I think, has this quote where it's, you know, in a depression, the more lavish the expenditure, the better. But the closer we get to full employment, the more surgical, and I'm totally paraphrasing, but he says the more targeted the expenditure needs to be. It is harder to get to full employment the closer we get through aggregate measures. So he has completely preempted the whole Phillips curve, you know, and even hydraulic view of the interpretation of his work. And, you know, many folks still to this day think that he's all about, you know, boosting aggregate demand. But no, you know, there's far more nuance that we can get into this now. But it was a targeted demand and a much more precise way in which we use public investment specifically, not just public spending, but public investment and public employment specifically to address social and economic needs. So yes, it's a deeper theoretical question because we need to shake off this view that somehow we can fine tune the economy. And that then raises difficult questions. You know, if you're a financial, if you're the central bank and interest rates are, as you know, we call it, a blunt tool, and it doesn't, you know, it's not terribly effective at achieving multiple economic objectives, what do we do? And then that means that there is a role for the central bank to do more careful regulation, perhaps, oversight. These are difficult questions, but that's where we need to go. When it comes to fiscal policy, it's not just a matter of passing a large budget. We clearly were able to do this $2.2 trillion CARES Act. How? Who gets it? Did it validate the bad investment decisions of speculators? Did it provide income support and living, living income and support for families and households? Did it erode the income distribution? We know that the way policy has been conducted in the post-war era and specifically in the post-Reagan era, it has been through this fine-tuning trickle-down model that has exacerbated income inequality. So the job guarantee for me is a direct solution to a pressing problem. It's sort of the shortest distance between two points. If somebody needs a job, we can directly provide it. It is also a policy that kind of eradicates a large proportion of involuntary unemployment by securing a living wage floor. It lifts up the floor for all. So it won't be a solution to all sources of income inequality, but it will raise the floor immediately. So it raises the bottom faster, and then you have to do something else about incomes at the top. But it has these structural, it contributes to some of these structural changes in the macroeconomy. It's also a permanent policy that is put in place to be available in all sorts of conditions. In downturns, it expands, but in good times, in expansions, it shrinks, but still employs the residual labor force that cannot find employment. And so it is a far better macroeconomic stabilizer. So, you know, so in that sense, it is a rethinking of structural fiscal policy. And it's an alternative to the sort of fine-tuning philosophy that seems to exist out there in the economics profession.
Let's explore for a minute the difference between the global South and the more developed advanced countries. A country like the United States, a reserve currency country, has its own currency. They can issue what they want, what you might call the MMT-like qualities are, how do they say, very hard to disagree with. But in an emerging economy that doesn't have a well-developed financial or credit market, where many people are borrowing through the shadow banking system, often in foreign currencies, and I guess what I'm getting at is the job guarantee kind of logic as applicable to places where the financial markets is a Green New Deal. This is a very important thing for places like India and Brazil. Is the Green New Deal viable if these societies have a much more difficult time with the financing, and obviously also the tensions of being at an earlier stage of development? Poverty and disease are looming large, if anybody wants to think of it in terms of trade-offs. But how do you see the difference between the advanced and the emerging countries or the underdeveloped countries of the global south with regard to these structural policies?
Yes, I mean, there are a couple of questions to explore here. The first is, can you implement a job guarantee in a small open economy that doesn't have its reserve currency? And the answer to that question is yes, not the least because some of the biggest and boldest programs that we implemented in recent history, very much modeled after the job guarantee, took place in the global south. Argentina, after their crisis in 2001, implemented something very similar to what the program I'm discussing. South Africa has had an expanded public works program, very successful and renewed. Also, the only job guarantee that is permanent, not as a crisis policy, but it is permanent, is the Rural Employment Guarantee Act in India that guarantees 100 days of rural employment to a rural family. So these countries are clearly able to embark on bold employment programs that have features that very much mimic the job guarantee, and they don't have the reserve currency. So the development of advanced financial market to me is not a precondition for implementing the program because it is a public policy. It is publicly funded, and any country that has the in a sense, its own currency that it can that is freely floating and it's not subject to some artificial restrictions, legal restrictions like currency boards, which the Argentina had prior, can go and expand expenditure for the purposes of employing the unemployed. The second aspect to your question is that, well, there may be other challenges that those countries are facing. And so the fact that you're able to use your own domestic currency, employ the unemployed, is certainly going to be an improvement over not doing it. But does that mean that we have accomplished some of the other economic stabilization goals that we're looking for? And it may be that a country in a poor developing country that is resource dependent will face problems importing energy, importing food. And so price stability will very much depend on these other external factors. The job guarantee in and of itself is a counter-cyclical policy. So what I like to say is that the job guarantee doesn't introduce inflationary pressures. It tames the cycle better than unemployment, but it is not a panacea to other sources of inflation that might be imported inflation or extreme market power within the domestic market. Certain industries may have monopoly pricing power. So those will be other policies that would be absolutely required to address that. And of course, you know, food insecurity, energy insecurity are going to be very important. They're going to limit the capacity of a sovereign currency issuing government to manage its macroeconomic affairs.
Well, Pablina, I think that you've covered a lot of ground here. And I want to inspire people to read this book. I think it's the kind of, what you might call, the kind of medicine we need for the illness we have. I know you've done very interesting INET supported research over time, and we're very grateful that you're such a strong and creative voice. And I think now is the time. I often am inspired by artistic representations of what it feels like when I'm working or talking with people. And as I was listening to you, I wanted to cite for you the first verse of a song by Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes that was sung by Teddy Pendergrass. And then the second verse is what I think pertains to you and your career. And I want to celebrate that slightly. In the first verse, which I think is kind of my anthem for the time we live in, it says, "Wake up, everybody. No more sleeping in bed. No more backward thinking. Time for thinking ahead. The world has changed so very much from what it used to be. There is so much hatred, war, and poverty." So that is the challenge. But it's the second verse that I was reminded of as I was listening to you. "Wake up, all the teachers. Time to teach a new way. Maybe then they'll listen to what you have to say. Because they're the ones who are coming up, and the world is in their hands. When you teach the children, teach them the very best you can." Well, I think our listeners got 55 minutes of that good new teaching because you decided to come on this podcast. And I think that, how would I say, from I've known you for years, and you've been at that vanguard of new teaching. And we need you now more than ever.
Thank you, Rob. This means a lot to me, especially because I, you know, poetry is very close to my heart. I'm going to maybe just end this with a quote of my own that I find, you know, very, you know, kind of guiding. And it's by Seneca. And it basically goes like this. "It's not because things are difficult that we do not dare. It's because we do not dare that they are difficult." So I thank you for all of your work in highlighting the new ideas of scholars who hopefully dare to think differently.
Yeah, you are what you might call at the core of the hopefulness that we have to reinvigorate for our future. Thanks for joining me today. We'll talk again
soon. Thank you, Rob. Thank you.
Bye-bye. And check out more from the Institute for New Economic Thinking at ineteconomics.org.
And I'll tell it and speak it and think it and breathe it. And reflect from the mountains so all souls can see it. And I'll stand on the ocean until I start sinking. But I'll know my song well before I start singing.